WSLR, LP 96.5 FM in Sarasota, and WBPD LP 100.1 FM in Bradenton. This is Johannes Werner with your WSLR news headlines for Tuesday, December 9th. In the middle of a market downturn, Sarasota County is likely to approve thousands more homes. The panel in charge of making recommendations and development proposals to the Sarasota County Commission last week overwhelmingly endorsed a project to build 9,000 homes at Winchester Ranch in Northport. The Sarasota County Planning Commission voted 7-1 for the project, whose construction could begin in 2027. The panel members who voted for Winchester Ranch argued the project had already been largely approved earlier, it checked all the boxes, and that they trusted builders will stop building if they cannot make a profit. The lone dissenter was John Thaxton, an environmentalist and former county commissioner who was appointed to the Planning Commission earlier this year. Thaxton expressed doubts about the project's fiscal neutrality, cited publicly funded infrastructure needs, and pointed out that it borders the Mayaca State Forest. The County Commission will vote on the Winchester Ranch rezone request early next year. A scammer from Georgia who managed to get Manatee County to send him close to $1.4 million pleaded guilty. 2 years ago, the 26-year-old man used fake letterheads from local developer Neil Land and Neighborhoods, a falsified tax form, and a fake letter of credit to trick the Manatee County clerk of the circuit court into making two bank transfers. The $1.37 million were supposed to reimburse Neil for construction of Fort Hamer Road in Parrish. The county has so far recovered a little more than $500,000, according to the Bradenton Herald. No surprise here. A survey by USF researchers found that the immigration crackdown has driven Florida immigrant families into isolation and hiding. In 53 in-depth interviews conducted between January and July, the USF report paints a picture of people not going to work, church, the doctor, or grocery stores, and avoiding any contact with law enforcement. The effects range from insomnia, loss of appetite, or overeating to anxiety, depression, fatigue, and hair loss. This has been Johannes Werner with your WSLR News headlines for Tuesday, December 9th.
You are listening to WSLR 96.5 FM in Sarasota,
of a previously aired episode.
We're
pleased
FM
to bring it
Bradenton.
Back to our listeners.
This is show 75 of our changing environment. The
on
previous
Tuesday,
show
January
was Melody Matrix, hosted
Urbanville
by Neil.
I'm Julie Morris.
I'm John O'Miller, and the show is being recorded and broadcast on December 9th, 2025.
Experiences. Today we're Tickets going to be talking about Perico Preserve and other topics with
That's
Elliot Prout, the president
Tuesday,
of the
January
local Saranoa chapter of the Florida Native Plant Society.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Elliot, it's great to have you back on the show to talk about an interesting site in Manatee County, the Perico Preserve. What's your history with this Manatee County Park?
Yeah, thank you for having me. It's always a pleasure to see you guys and be on the show. My history with the park is actually relatively recent. I went down the rabbit hole of native plants in 2020. Like a lot of people, I kind of discovered my passion through isolation and through being at home and looking at nature. I became a master gardener that year, and as part of the volunteering that I did for that organization, I started doing these nature tours at Perico Preserve. And the primary reason I wanted to do that was to educate the public about native plants, ecosystems, and everything that entails. So it's been a lot of fun. Really, the last 5 years, I do 8 tours a year, so I've done over 40 tours there. And I've tried to learn as much about the history of the site and the restoration that happened there as possible.
But I know so we had to take a very good dessert. There are a lot of interesting parts
it is the closest preserve to my house, so that helps. But also, you know, I grew up in the area, so I remember driving past it when it was just like farmland, and it was like nothing, and I saw the whole restoration happen through high school, college, so it's just got a really interesting story to me.
So, for listeners who aren't familiar with it, we probably should explain where Perico Preserve is located.
It's on the north side of Manatee Avenue after you cross the causeway on Palmasola Bay.
Right, you go by they still have the horses riding in the bay, right?
That's right.
So you go by the horses, and then there's another little water body, and then there's a development, which if you use your Google Maps or whatever, they end up taking you into a residential development, isn't that right?
That's right.
So you have to go past that and turn into a small parking area. So, let's see. All right, so Perico Preserve. So just give us the basics. Do you happen to know how big a preserve it is?
Yeah, it's relatively small, but it's a good size for where it's located. So it's 176 acres.
Wow.
Most of that is wetlands, mangrove forest, but they also have quite a bit of uplands as well that they've built into the preserve.
Yeah, new uplands.
Yeah.
So this is basically the same story that we see at the celery fields and Lefis Key, where people excavate to make a low wet area lower and open water, and then they pile up the material that they've dug out. And so that was the plan at Perico Preserve.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, this is maybe a little bit different because they didn't dredge the bay or the bayou.
Right.
They basically tore up the entire property.
Right.
Right. It's just degraded farmland. And they used this sand that they dug out to build up these uplands.
Right.
So every water body within Perico Preserve is man-made. So it's kind of interesting. They kind of played God, if you will, and like created wetlands and uplands and all these different habitats with that.
Now, do you happen to know, does Manatee County still have the original planting diagrams of what was put in so they can figure out what survived and what didn't?
I'm sure that list exists somewhere.
Yeah. The map would be more valuable than the list to see where they actually put stuff.
Yeah. There's two different ways that they restored the property. So they started with having volunteers and county staff doing plantings of actual plants and trees. But then they also seeded parts of the property too. It's a lot less expensive. They collected seed from different preserves out east. It had a local ecotype and then spread that across for the grasses and the wildflowers and things like that.
Well, so presumably, Julie, you think it was pineland before it was
pine? Pine flatwoods before.
Pretty low. And so that was cleared out, and it went into agricultural production. But there was probably a relatively thin veneer of soil with a living biota in it. Mm-hmm. And then they went in and dredged up all this subsoil and piled that up, which is relatively sterile and challenging for a lot of plants.
Oh, yeah.
I need to reintroduce Elliot.
Okay.
And Elliot is the president of the local Saranoa chapter of the Florida Native Plant Society, and we're talking with him today about Perico Preserve and other topics.
Yeah, great. Thanks so much for having me.
Yeah.
I really love this topic because anytime you preserve a property, especially if you're taking it from degraded land with a lot of invasive species into a preserve, it's never going to be 100% pristine. It's not the ideal scenario, but I think it is a success story that we can point to of like this property became a preserve instead of another development.
Yeah.
And it's something that, you know, residents can enjoy. It does make up a 1,200 acre wildlife corridor between Robinson's, which adjoins it directly, Robinson Preserve, Perico Preserve, and then Neal Preserve, which is across the street. And those are properties that typically, we see it often in Sarasota, Manatee, they just become condo developments, and that was exactly what was slated to happen to Perico Preserve in 2007, 2008. But that deal fell through with the Great Recession, coming through, and the county was able to purchase the property. So I think it's got a cool story, and then it's, you know, it's not perfect, but it's a good education opportunity for the public to see, you know, the plants that are there, the ecosystems, and teach them about that.
So was this followed the restoration efforts at Robinson?
Correct.
Okay, so Robinson was sort of the test case for, can we take degraded coastal agricultural areas and get something with a predominance of native plants?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, I think that was definitely part of it. They looked at the success they had with Robinson's. They said, we can mimic that here, and it's just right across the bayou. But it was designed with a little bit different purpose. Robinson's, if you've been there, you know, they've got paved trails, they have bikers, they have rollerblades, people are walking their dogs. It's, you know, it has a lot of different activities you can do.
Right.
Preco Preserve was designed more for, like, wildlife in mind. So, for example, you're not allowed to have dogs at the preserve. Obviously, you can't rollerblade. You can only bike on parts of the trails.
Right.
So it's a little bit more quiet and peaceful in that way.
So what's the name of the body of water that separates the two?
Preco Bayou.
Preco Bayou. Okay.
Yeah.
And there's a trail that actually leads across the bayou. So you could, if you were ambitious, you could start at Robinson and walk all the way over to Preco.
Yep. Yeah. A couple of years ago, they finally opened this trail that adjoins the two.
Uh-huh.
So it's all part of the same trail system now.
Right.
Yeah.
So does the trail go over the water? What happens?
It actually like kind of skirts the water.
Yeah.
There's parts where they had to build like wooden bridges and boardwalks and things like that to connect it.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a pretty narrow trail. You know, at points it's only maybe, you know, the whole entire trail is 10 feet wide.
But it's a historic route across the bayou, right?
Mm. I believe so. Yeah. It looks like it's been there before, yeah.
Right. So it was there, and then I think that there was like a causeway on either side, it looks like, and then there was open water where the majority of the flow would pass through. And I guess that bridge section washed out or was removed, and so they probably had to restore that in order to create the pedestrian link again.
Mm-hmm.
So looking at historic aerials, it was converted to agricultural row crop fields starting in 1951.
Yeah.
Or at least
probably way before 51. We don't have aerial photography before 51.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, my understanding is, as far back as we have aerial photography, it's been farmland.
Mm-hmm.
My records indicate maybe as early as like the 1920s, it was farmland.
Mm-hmm.
And as part of the restoration, which started in 2012, they wanted to try to restore the property to as close as what it might have been before humans intervened, right? They didn't have a real good idea of, as far as what it might have been. Obviously, you said pine flatwoods. And there are surveyor notes from the 1840s that talk about you know, just surveying the plants on this property, and it talks about pine trees, saw palmetto, different things like that. So we know that it was pine flatwoods before it was farmland. And then in addition to that, when they were digging out some of these wetlands, they found these huge pine tree stumps that were like 5 feet in circumference.
Wow.
That were all cut, you know, clear cut.
Yeah.
So that was a really interesting discovery to see like the old forest that had been cut down.
Mm-hmm.
Like 95% of the southeast, right?
Mm-hmm.
It was original old growth forest and then logged.
And we have a similar situation along Sarasota Bay and what were the gladiola fields. And those were in agricultural production and are being replaced by residential.
Residential, yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Multifamily residential.
Yeah. And this was gladiolus fields too.
Really?
Yeah.
So gladiolas must have been a big deal. And
yeah.
That's sort of the answer to the caladiums out at Lake Placid or wherever.
Yeah.
So,
my house was also a gladiolus farm as well.
Yeah,
and before it was built in 1930.
That's really interesting because It's not something I think about planting in the yard.
Yeah. So gladiolas must have had a market, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And they were able to grow them and sell them profitably.
Yeah. The other thing they grew at Preco was citrus trees.
citrus,
which obviously had a market too.
Yeah.
There's an interesting story that Damon Moore talks about where he found an old newspaper article from whatever year, 1930s sometime, and there was a really bad freeze in Florida that year, and it killed like the majority of the citrus crop.
Yeah.
But the oranges at Preco Preserve survived because they're coastal.
Right.
Yeah.
They did not freeze. And the article talks about the Preco Preserve oranges. So it's kind of interesting that they were like one of the few citrus crops that survived that year in Manatee County at that site.
Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the site and the native plants that are there.
Okay.
Yeah. I know you guys got to explore this past weekend, so...
Yeah, Saturday evening.
Yeah.
Went out. Yeah.
What stood out to you?
Well, you had pre-warned us that there's a lot of... there's sort of a ghost forest forming of live oaks that were probably severely impacted by the storms last year. And so these oaks are either dead or dying mostly. There's a relatively small area of remnant oak hammock, mm-hmm. and it's in trouble.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that section of the preserve is likely on its way out, as you saw. The majority of the preserve was this farmland, but there was this one little section that was never farmed, and they kept that, and that was all these mature live oaks, even slash pines are there.
Yeah.
But it borders the bayou. Actually, if you look, behind the oak trees, you can see, like, these black mangrove roots that are popping up, so they're very close to the salt water. And just in the past, really, 24 months, that section has been affected by storm surge probably 5 or 6 times, especially during Hurricane Helene.
Yeah.
And live oak trees, they're notorious. Like, they can survive some saltwater inundation.
Yeah.
But when it's flooding 2-3 times every year, it's taking a toll on them for sure.
Well, and I'm sure it makes a difference whether it's a saltwater inundation issue alone. If you have saltwater accompanied by heavy rainfall, that would tend to flush out or dilute the salt. But if the salt just washes up in there and there's no rain to speak of, then... those salty soils are problematic.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The other thing is, there's probably saltwater intruding on the root zone of some of these trees.
Yeah.
You know, live oaks, they actually don't have a very deep root system, but it does, eventually. I think this section of oak hammock at the preserve will become more of like a mangrove forest, and you can kind of see that transition happening in real time.
Uh-huh.
Actually, if you walk down the trail, you'll see this big, giant, dead live oak tree that's 100 years old, and then right next to it there's like a little white mangrove seedling that's propagating.
That's a great story.
Yeah.
And that trail also, there's a tree that's tipped over and you walk underneath the tree.
Yeah,
kids would like that.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because adults have to stoop down and they could run under it.
Yeah, that tree is really cool. It keeps sinking every year.
Yeah?
It's getting lower. You used to be able to drive a golf cart underneath of it, but now it's you've got to do the limbo to get under.
Yeah. All right.
So some of the plants we saw were Dalbergia and...
And that's what I call coin vine?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that's a...
And then there's also...
Well, let's talk about...
Knicker bean.
Yeah. Well, let's not get ahead of ourselves.
Okay.
So the coin vine has pretty big leaves, but it will clamber up into trees, right? Into the canopy of other plants.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's a pretty common vine to see in coastal, mangrove habitat.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And, you probably saw some of the vines there are really big and really mature. They almost look like Tarzan vines that you could swing on.
Yeah.
And coin vine obviously has a big history with the Native American populations here. They would use the roots of that vine, grind them into a powder, and then they would spread that powder over the water. And it has some type of chemical in it that... essentially asphyxiates the fish, so they can't absorb oxygen through their gills. They come to the surface, and then they can easily spear them or scoop them out with a net. So that was a commonly used plant by our...
Excellent.
Yeah.
And then what was the other vine you mentioned?
Gray knicker bean.
Yeah. And we saw that really on the east side more than the west side. Is that true?
No. It was right along the trail.
When we were walking in?
No, when we were walking out.
Wouldn't that have been the east side?
Yeah.
Okay, I apologize for being right about that. So, yeah, nicobean, that's a host plant for the Miami blue butterfly, which used to be found here. And people don't like it because it's
very thorny.
It's thorny.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it's a great plant, and it's coastal. And a lot of it was removed at New College. We had a good stand of it that was actually used. They were rearing Miami blue butterflies in Gainesville to help reestablish the populations. And we were shipping the leaves up there to keep the larva going. Mm. But now that's not an option because New College pulled it all out. Mm-hmm. But they have beautiful seeds. They look like they're porcelain. They're these gray, smooth gray seeds.
Oh, yes.
But they're in very spiny pods.
Right. It's a juxtaposition of this sort of spiny purse with these smooth gray seeds inside.
Yeah. That plant is so interesting because, as you said, that the stems are just full of thorns.
Yeah.
Like there's not a millimeter where there's not a thorn. The leaves have like hooked thorns underneath of them, so they'll hook into your clothes and they won't let you go. The seed pods look incredibly intimidating. They're just covered in spikes, although they're kind of soft. And then, you have these beautiful kind of beads inside, and I've seen people use those to make jewelry. I mean, they're kind of like stones. They're so hard.
Yeah.
And both of those plants, the nicobean and the coin vine, are both legumes. So they're in the pea family.
Uh-huh.
And those, they basically take nitrogen from the air and use that nitrogen to grow. So they do really well in Florida because we have such poor soil here. And they do deposit some nitrogen into the soil as well, so they're important for neighboring plants.
Okay, what else did you see, Julie?
We saw a lot of cabbage palms.
Right, and a lot of them were planted.
And so they're evenly spaced?
And it'd be interesting to see when they were planted. But then there are a lot of volunteers out there as well.
Mm-hmm.
And the volunteers are... If you see a palm that's under 10 feet tall and has all its bootjacks on it, it's a volunteer. Nobody was messing around. Yeah.
Well, I was surprised to see, because there is the section on the east side has a lot of cabbage palms.
Yeah.
And it looks like most of those were volunteers or planted when they were very small. And I was surprised to see the growth rate because they weren't planted more than 10 years ago. We know that. So, like, you know, based on your book, I know there's different growth rates
depending on
the genetics and the growing conditions. But it's interesting to see some of these are 20 feet tall.
Yeah.
And they're only, you know, eight years old, maybe.
And they like shelly soil. So,
they're fine with saltwater inundation.
Yeah, they're flood and wind and fire tolerant. And we did see signs of fire out there as well.
Mm hmm.
There was clumps of grass that had been burned, and it just burned back to the roots, almost to the roots, that hadn't resprouted, and then some had resprouted.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. Like the type of ecosystem that they recreated, like this pine flatwoods, you know, as you guys know, it needs to burn really once every 1 to 2 years to mimic the natural fire cycle that would have happened in Florida. So they do that intentionally at the preserve. You know, they have fires, and they're pretty good about every year, basically. Every 1 to 2 years, they put a fire through there. And the challenging part is it's a relatively small preserve, and it's surrounded on three sides by development. So you really have to time it right with the wind, where it's blowing out to the water.
Yeah,
it's a skillful thing.
We were impressed with that fire. Now, on the other side, we are starting to see invasive exotics coming in.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if the county has a program to really get on top of that, but those things, you're much better off spending a bunch of money at the front end than trying to do it later on.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. They do have people that are on top of that, but I think in general the county is relatively short-staffed with resources, and there's maybe more important properties to allocate this kind of invasive control on than you know, something small like Preco Preserve. But every now and then I will see, you know, they'll spray some pest or herbicide on a invasive plant that I've been looking at for the last 3 years. I try to help too. Anytime I'm walking and I see a little Brazilian pepper, I'll pluck it out.
There's peppers out there. Mm-hmm. I didn't see any Australian pine.
Be part of the live WSLR audience when Talk of the Town, hosted by Carrie Seidman, returns this Saturday, December 13th at 11 a.m. at Fogartyville. Seidman will be joined at the round table by Longboat Key Mayor Ken Schneier, Sarasota City Manager Dave Bullock, and Mark Massferer of the Bradenton Journal. They'll be talking about the governor's proposal to eliminate property taxes for homeowners and how that would impact housing prices and local services. It's an hour of analysis and debate with a dash of humor, broadcast on WSLR and live streamed on YouTube. Doors open at 10:15, no arrivals after 10:45 a.m. due to the nature of the live broadcast. For more information and free tickets to Saturday's Talk of the Town, visit WSLR.org or call 941-894-6469.
Yeah, I think Carrie says Seidman.
Seidman.
I think so.
Okay.
But we can clarify that up. And, you know, we'll have to have a whole show about these issues related to
property.
Changing the tax structure, because
yeah.
Our environmental land program and Manatee's environmental land program both depend on ad valorem taxes. So that'll be something worth watching. So we have a couple of minutes. I posted some photos on Facebook of a curious phenomenon taking place out there, and if you go to our Facebook group on our changing environment, you'll see these photos of a bunch of, I don't know, maybe 20 cabbage palms, and they all have a little white dot associated with the canopy. So did you get a chance to look at those, Julie?
No.
So, Elliot, do you have any thoughts?
I got a chance to look at it, and I've been racking my brain, and I'm not sure what that would be, unless there's a white ibis that's perched on top of each one.
That's right. So one theory is there's an individual white bird perched. Each bird gets its own palm tree, and that's possible if they were particularly territorial or setting up shop or something. That would be one option. You have any thoughts, Joel?
I think it's just a photographic anomaly.
And what would cause that anomaly?
I think the shadow of the cabbage palm is evident on the aerial, and
right.
That the white dot is somehow in response to the shadow.
Okay. Well, my theory, when I first saw it, I thought it might be a white bird perched niche, and then I thought, well, there might have been instead of the usual tripod to support a planted cabbage palm, there might have been a single post, but that seemed unlikely. And my current theory goes back to John Muir, and we live in a time when there's a lot of particulate air pollution, and so a lot of plants are covered with fine particulates that we're not really aware of, but affect their appearance. When Muir walked through Florida after the Civil War, he was really impressed by cabbage palms, and said he learned more from a cabbage palm than any priest. And he was a pretty religious guy. But he wrote, He said he was really fascinated by the tropic light reflecting off its fronds and sparks and splinters and long red stars. So I could imagine if these aerial images were taken after a rain and there was one part of each frond that was clean and reflecting sunlight, it would be just as if someone had a hand mirror and was reflecting light up towards the sensor and the satellite or the air, whatever they were using for their remote sensing. So that would make sense of the location of all of these dots seem to be on about the same location of the cabbage palm. So mm-hmm. My personal theory is that it's light reflecting off a particularly clean and reflective palm frond. But I'm interested to see if some of our listeners who have access to Facebook or my web page on Facebook have other thoughts.
Elliot, do you have any other thoughts?
Well, now that he mentions that, I could see that.
It's possible.
Yeah. It's more likely than a single bird on every tree. I'll say that. Yeah.
Let me reintroduce our guest. Today we're talking with Elliot Prout, the president of the local Saranoa chapter of the Florida Native Plant Society, about Perico Preserve. And the Literacy Council of Sarasota is looking for adult tutor volunteers who want to help other adults improve their basic English communication and literacy skills. No previous experience required. Volunteers will receive orientation and instruction during 4 weekday sessions in January. Space is limited and pre-registration is required by Friday, January 2nd. More information and sign up is available by calling Program Director Susan Bergstrom at 941-955-0421 or by emailing sbergstrom at sarasotaliteracy.org. And we need to do station identification right now.
It's still WSLR.
It's WSLR 95.1.
Oh, wait.
96.5 FM and Sarasota WBPV 100.1 FM in Bradenton.
Now, Elliot, before you went out there, you told us to be on the lookout for an invasive exotic, and is that it?
Yes.
Yeah, so our radio listeners can see this plant quite clearly, but it's an Ardisia?
Yeah, shoe button.
Shoe button. So shoes used to, instead of lacing up, they would button up with small black buttons, and I guess some animals, chicks maybe, are referred to as having shoe button eyes. So any small dark seed, in fact, a cabbage palm seed is probably close to being shoe buttony. At any rate, we saw this invasive plant growing out there in that hammock area.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's unfortunately, it's like a pretty attractive plant, I think. It's got pretty foliage and things like that. It's closely related to our native marlberry.
Uh-huh.
You know, they're in the same genus. And it's also closely related to coralberry, which is another invasive plant. So all three of these plants like Florida soil.
Uh-huh.
But this particular, the shoe button Ardisia, is it's kind of taking over that oak hammock that we talked about in the understory. I see new plants popping up every time I go there.
Yeah.
And it wasn't in there. I never saw it in the preserve until about 4 years ago.
Yeah.
It's typically like a 10A plant, maybe even a zone 11.
Uh-huh.
And it's been creeping further and further north. So it's really well established in Perico now.
It seems like a pretty prolific seed producer.
It is for sure. Yeah. And the birds love to eat them and spread them all around. So,
right.
Yeah.
Well, let's go back to some of the other native plants. There was a bunch of muley grass.
Yeah.
Yeah. And,
real quick on the muley grass. They do have just a plethora of muley grass if anybody's ever been there.
Uh-huh.
And I would highly recommend, if this encourages you to go visit Perico Preserve, I would go there the last week of October.
Okay.
That's when muley grass is in full bloom, and it's absolutely stunning.
Well, we don't have calls to action on this show, so we don't tell people to go do something.
Oh, yeah.
But if you are interested in visiting the preserve, you're recommending the last week of October?
Okay. That would be the best time,
Yeah, it's fantastic. And, boy, I saw a beauty berry that just, I couldn't believe it. We saw it from a trail, and I saw this from a distance look like red. And then when I got closer, it was the distinctive magenta fruit of the beauty berry, and the beauty berry was a good sized plant, and it lost most of its leaves, so it was just on fire. It was very dramatic. And then nearby there was pokeweed with its dark purple berries that was pretty sensational looking too. Mm-hmm. Now we should mention there's when they created does the pond or lake have a name? Has it?
It may have a name.
Okay. Well, at any rate, when they excavated the farmland to create open water and get the fill to build the higher elevations, they left a small island in the center. And if you look at the old aerial photographs, they put some structures out there. I guess they were hoping for roosting or nesting wading birds.
That's right.
And that hasn't really materialized.
Not yet. Yeah, that little island was designed as like an overflow rookery for birds, wading birds to nest at. And it took a while to get vegetated. You can't plant full-growth mangrove trees when you're restoring a property. So I think they put up these like cross-like structures.
Yeah.
So at a minimum, birds could roost there, you know, and rest with the hope of eventually, as the mangroves grow in, that birds would nest there. And so far, I haven't seen any wading birds nesting there in any large numbers.
Right.
But the mangroves are getting quite large. Actually, they're big enough now where you can't really see the structures in person unless you're looking for them, right?
So we stopped at a little overlook, and Julie got out the binoculars, and there appears to be a plastic egret stuck out there.
A decoy. A plastic egret.
Yeah. So my...
Those are actually... they were like the flamingos that you put in your yard, and they dunked them in white paint. And there used to be 20, and now there's probably like two left every storm.
So I don't want to be overly pessimistic, but I don't think it's the optimal design if they wanted birds to roost and nest there. And that's because there's upland associated with it. So what that means is if a raccoon or to swim out to that site and be attracted by birds or smell or whatever, once it got there, it could just stay there. In some of the more successful created rookeries, they just come straight up out of the water. And so, you might have some predation. Some animal, a snake or a raccoon or whatever, might go out there and predate some of the nests. But they can't just hang out there because there's no land. But this tiny little island has an upland component in the center, and I think that's going to make it a lot less attractive to the birds, personally.
Yeah, it could be right. I mean, nothing's nested on it yet. I know it was designed with the dimensions, like it's far enough from land, it's out of depth, you know, that predators like raccoons wouldn't want to take on. But, yeah, it could be that. I know they tried to make the elevation at a high enough spot where part of it remains above water, except a couple of years it flushes, right? Because a healthy mangrove system needs to flush every now and then. But we'll see. Yeah.
So they created two inlets or outlets, I guess, depending on the tide, to connect with Perico Bayou. And one has a pretty sizable or noticeable delta, the submerged delta that's forming on the intake. And if I was going to make a suggestion for Manatee County about that, I think it would be nice to have a landing so that people that were kayaking or canoeing in Perico Bayou could come in and get out and walk around and get on the trail for a while, dry their butts out or whatever, and then go back and explore. That would be a nice addition, in my opinion.
So, I noticed that there were buttonwood mangroves invading under the... They're young buttonwoods, and they're invading under the live oaks and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's in response to the salt tolerance of buttonwood, and maybe the... We saw this in the Florida Keys on Lower Matacumbe. We were doing some consulting down there, and buttonwoods were invading tropical hammock on Lower Matacumbe.
Yeah, I mean, if that's the case, it's very similar at Perico. You have the buttonwoods. I mentioned the white mangroves that are popping up.
Yeah.
Really, everything within that hammock is like only salt tolerant plants now. Like there's sea grapes that are thriving. There's a few remaining cabbage palms.
So Elliot, we can come back to Perico, but we should give you a chance to talk about the local chapter of the Florida Native Plant Society and what it's up to and what's happening. So is there anything you want to share with us about that?
Sure. Yeah. So the Saranoa chapter of the Florida Native Plant Society encompasses Sarasota. It's primarily our members are from Sarasota and Manatee County, but we also encompass Hardy and DeSoto County as well. And I know it's just a bunch of people that like native plants, but we have a pretty good sized membership. We have about 420 members. And we have monthly events. So every month we have a meeting at Selby Gardens. It's the third Monday of each month, starting at 6:30. And then we have a speaker that starts at 7. And they'll talk about native plants or restoration or conservation. There's all different kinds of topics we have. We just had Sean Patton speak on wetland restoration and aquatic butterfly gardening. We have Jim Strickland, who's a rancher out east and does like regenerative ranching and in accordance with wildlife and helping these kind of things. He's going to be one of our speakers. So we have all kinds of interesting topics. And then we also have a field trip every month as well. So like our next one will be at Mayaca State Park.
Classic.
Yeah, right?
Yeah.
And that'll be like a little Christmas walk the day, I think a couple days after Christmas or before.
Well, this is coming up on the best time of year to be out. Well, the fall's good for the fall wildflowers, but in terms of temperature, winter is the best time to get out there.
Yeah, it's like we only have like 4 months in Florida to actually explore outside, right? So, yeah, we try to take advantage. Actually, in the summer, like the two hottest months during the summer, we don't have any programs because there's less people here, but also it's just too hot to really, you know, do something outside in a group activity.
So if people wanted to connect with the local Native Plant Society, do you have a website or what would they do?
Yeah, we do have a website. It's probably easiest just to Google Saranoa Florida Native Plant Society.
Yeah.
And our website will pop up as the first result.
And then first you have to figure out how to spell Saranoa. So maybe you'll start by Googling Florida chapter of the Native Plant Society, Florida Native Plant Society, and then you could get to the Saranoa chapter that way.
Yeah, I'm sure you could say Sarasota, Florida Native Plant Society, and it would pop up,
So Saranoa is the genera name for the saw palmetto.
Yeah, but it's a lot of fun. You know, we have a really good group. We have a super engaged board. We have like 14 people on our board of directors. I've been the president for the last 2 years, and I've only been a member for 4 or 5 years. So it's just something I'm really passionate about, like to share.
Well, let me switch gears for a second. Sarasota Memorial Hospital's Health Connection is holding a Stop the Bleed training on Thursday, December 11th. So that's coming up from 11 a.m. to 12:15 p.m. Attendees will learn from a Sarasota Memorial trauma expert how to recognize a life-threatening bleed and how to intervene effectively. The class location is at 1700 South Tamiami Trail in Sarasota, near the B elevators and across from the gift shop. Registration is required. For more information and registration, that's available at smh.com. So sarasotamemorialhospital.com, smh.com.
So, Elliot, what other signs of rising sea level are you seeing at Perico Preserve?
Yeah, so there is an ecosystem in Florida called a salt barren or salt flat. Some people call it a salt tern. And it's an ecosystem that typically lives behind the mangroves. And it's an endangered ecosystem in Florida because typically the way that we're set up is we have a little patch of mangroves and then we have some sort of development or human thing behind it. And the natural progression is you would have mangroves and then behind the mangroves you have this salt flat. But there's just nowhere for that. As mangroves move backwards, as sea levels rise, there's nowhere for that salt flat to go, right? So I'm seeing that play out in real time in Perico where it has room to move backwards, where it was, there's a little strip of mangroves. Behind that was like this pine flatwoods. But as we get these storm surges, I'm seeing that the pine flatwoods, like the grasses and the pines, are dying. And it's just, now it's just barren sand, and there's these little plants propagating like saltwort, glasswort, sea purslane. All the plants that are typical of a salt flat are taking over that area. So it's been really interesting to watch that transition real time just in the last couple of years. It went from pine flatwoods to now it's like the salt flat environment, and it's cool to see. It's not a particularly, you know, it doesn't have a lot of variety as far as species that use it and plants that grow there. But it is important nonetheless to have that kind of diversity. The other thing is there's a small little freshwater lake that I've been keeping an eye on that's pretty close to the salt flat. It used to be freshwater. It used to be full of cattails. It was so full of cattails, you couldn't even really see the water. You know, it's just a bunch of cattails. And it's been inundated so many times with salt water that the salt has essentially killed all of the cattails. And now there's no vegetation growing around that little lake, or I should call it a pond. I think it's kind of in flux. It's trying to figure out what it is, right? It's like just salty enough where nothing freshwater can grow, but there's no mangroves that have started propagating either. So it'll be interesting to see what happens with that. But I think eventually that'll become like a little mangrove pond as opposed to a cattail marsh.
So the plants that you were mentioning are highly tolerant of high salinity in the soil, right?
In the salt flat.
In the salt flat, right.
Yeah, because salt flats are actually, the soil is more salty than even on the coastline, like in the mangroves.
Yeah.
And that's because as water washes up, as the tides wash up or a storm surge, the water evaporates, but the salt stays behind.
Yeah.
So it's actually too salty of an environment for mangroves, most mangroves, to even grow into.
Yeah.
Which is why it's mostly barren sand and these little kind of halophytes that grow in those areas.
Yeah, I think if you have a sort of a predictable slope from the mangroves to the uplands, you don't really see the salt turns form. But parts of Florida are so flat that like if you were to have a small berm washed up in a storm or whatever, so that the salt water gets trapped behind that and is in a flat area and just keeps evaporating, you get the salt turn. And they're very open and easy to walk around, and usually I usually see buttonwood mangrove. Some of the buttonwoods have epiphytes in there. That's pretty interesting. And then there's kind of characteristically a red, I don't know, is it a bacteria that's in the soil layer? They show up as pink frequently on aerial photography from, I believe it's a bacteria, but somebody can write into our Facebook group and contradict me if it's not a bacteria.
Hmm.
Yeah, they're fascinating sites, and they are sort of endangered. And
that's because of the single family homes meeting with the mangroves.
Yes, but also I think what's going on in addition is that the areas that were trapped or isolated where the salinity could build up, as the water levels rise, as sea level rises, there's more flushing action, and so they become less saline as more salt water is appearing, if that makes any sense.
But there are lots of salt barrens on Tidy Island, and that's because of this high concentration of salt in the soil.
There were a lot of salt barrens on Tidy Island. I haven't checked lately, but they've been decreasing in extent in my recollection.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah. What's happening is, I mean, the existing salt barrens are becoming mangrove forests.
Yeah.
You know, as there's more flushing, like Jono mentioned. Yeah, and then there has to be room for them to move backwards, right? Because that's the natural progression. If sea levels are getting higher, if there's nowhere for them to move, then they're just kind of like not existing anymore.
But you're seeing that on Perico Preserve, right?
They're moving backwards. Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
If you want to see a bunch of them, you could go look at Rattlesnake Key. There's a bunch up there, and some have that red signature, and others are almost snow white for whatever reason. And there's apparently news about Rattlesnake Key, but I couldn't interpret it. It both sounded like it had been purchased and was going to be protected, but also like it had been purchased and going to be developed, so I don't know which is.
Where is Rattlesnake Key?
It's as you're coming up to go to the Skyway, sort of where the Skyway toll area is, it would be off to the south of that, right where the Skyway starts. And it's a big island, and it should have been protected. It deserves to be protected. It's got lots of interesting features, sort of isolated ponds in it, and mangrove habitat, these saltern habitats. And then there's a, just like you see at Robinson Preserve, where the shoreline is adjacent to Tampa Bay, there's enough wave action to build up a berm. And so then you get the strangler figs and cabbage palms and some of that other habitat because there's greater elevation.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, Rattlesnake Key is interesting. I mean, it feels like that property's been in flux for decades, like since before the Skyway was built. And you're right. Like, there's contradictory news. It's like, oh, it's been preserved. It's a state park. And it's like, oh, no, it's being developed, like, 2 days later. So it's...
Maybe we could get... if someone is listening and wants to come on the show and... give us a deep background on Rattlesnake Key, that would be great.
Mm-hmm.
And it's fun, you know, I think because Julie and I live in Sarasota, we tend to focus on Sarasota-related stories, and now we've got a WBPV story for our Manatee listeners.
So anything else you'd like to share with our listening audience at this point, Elliot?
In regards to Preco Preserve, it's, you know, a couple other interesting things about the property is that they brought in gopher tortoises to the property because those historically would have been at that location. So FWC has what's called a WAIF gopher tortoise program, where basically any gopher tortoises that people bring in that they find or, you know, the development goes in and they have to remove the gopher tortoises. They need to find suitable homes for them. So when they established the preserve and once they got, you know, everything planted, they brought in, I believe it was 36 WAIF gopher tortoises to the property, and they had to fence them in with silt fencing. There was like a 15-acre area where they fenced them in, and then they dug their burrows. Because what happens with gopher tortoises is they have like a homing instinct where they'll try to walk back to their original burrow.
Yeah.
So if you just move one from Sarasota to Bradenton, it'll try to walk back to Sarasota. And so anyways, they had to fence them in, they dug new burrows, and now they have a gopher tortoise population, which is really cool because they're endangered, but also because they provide habitat for so many other animals. You know,
we saw two burrows, but previously, maybe they made an exception for Perico. When we inquired about WAIF tortoises at New College, they told us they could give us some, that they would have to be confined before, so they dug burrows, but that they would only give us all males or all females. They didn't want to start a reproducing population.
Interesting.
So were the 36 all one sex or another, or
I actually don't know the answer to that.
Have you seen any little baby Malamar-sized gopher tortoises out there?
I have not.
Yeah. So that would be good to know. It looks like good gopher habitat. We saw a prickly pear out there that didn't seem like the native prickly pear. It seemed like much bigger pads and longer spines than the one I associate.
I thought it was the native prickly pear.
Okay. Well, now we have a family dispute here. I wish I'd taken
a picture
different, of
there's
it.
We have like five or six different species of prickly pear, right? Some are more diminutive and some are larger. I think it's... Apuntia erecta is like the bigger one.
All right. Well, maybe I'm mistaking erecta for an invasive, non-native prickly pear.
Yeah. I'll agree. It's a native prickly pear. A 2-1.
Great. Yeah. All right. I concede.
But that is one of gopher tortoise's favorite foods.
Yeah.
You know, is this, you know, very, very spiny prickly pear that looks like it's not appetizing at all, but they love to eat it because... Yeah. It's got such a high moisture content.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, is there any gopher apple planted on Perico Preserve?
There may be. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. That's another one of their favorite foods, especially when it fruits.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Well, so it would be interesting to get a hold of the original planting list, even if you couldn't get a map, and see what's persisted. And I mean, you had mentioned this earlier. There's a battle going on out there of plants that are trying to find their footing. And, you know, they may have been planted like 10 feet outside of their optimal soil and elevation requirements. And they're like trying to slide over and get to a better site. Mm-hmm. So some of the cabbage palms are growing really vigorously, and others are struggling a little.
Yeah.
So it'll take a while for the whole site to get completely sorted out and mm-hmm. plants to figure out where they really want to be. They can't move as rapidly as as animals can.
Yeah, it's been interesting to watch the natural succession, you know, of like, I'll see a new seedling of like a red bay or something that obviously wasn't planted there. And it's just cool to see plants kind of growing where they want to grow.
Yeah.
Right. But yeah, that's the interesting thing about, you know, a tree or any kind of plant is that it literally can't move from where it's planted. So if a human decides where it goes, maybe they picked the right spot, maybe they didn't. But over time, over decades, it'll sort itself out.
Yeah.
Things will be where they want to be.
Yeah, I haven't been back up to the top of the hill at Celery Fields lately, but I've been waiting to see cabbage palm recruitment because they planted a bunch of palms on the top of the hill. But the question is, will there be another generation? So that's something to look for.
Mm-hmm.
So we saw a number of palm warblers while we were at Perico Preserve, and we saw a hawk. It might have been an immature red-shouldered hawk.
Flew off.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
There's it's a great birding spot. It's an area that, like, the Manatee County Audubon Society does a lot of trips to. And, you know, it's great for wading birds, but also migratory birds, too, because it's right along the coastline. And there's a lot of different habitats that are crammed into this little area. You know, you have wetlands, you have uplands, you have hardwood forests, you have freshwater wetlands as well as saltwater. So it's a really good birding place. And as a matter of fact, the last tour I did, which was a couple weeks ago, there was, I guess, a rare bird. It was the first sighting that's ever been in Manatee County. It's called the Groovebeak
Annie.
Yeah. And the parking lot was full, actually. There was nowhere to park. There was, like, overflow into the street. And I was like, what is going on? Like, is there, like, multiple tours today? And it was this bird that had showed up at the preserve. So that was kind of funny.
Yeah. We've got two Annies in Florida. And the grooved bill one has a grooved bill with mm-hmm. these little grooves
and it's mostly restricted to the Everglades area.
Yeah, that's where we've mm-hmm. seen them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
You've been listening to Our Changing Environment on listener-sponsored WSLR LP Radio 96.5 FM, broadcasting from our downtown Sarasota studios on Kumquat Court. You can also hear our show on WBPV LP Radio 100.1 Bradenton, or listen online.
Today's show, number 75, featured Native Plant Society's Elliot Prout talking about Perico Preserve.
The views and opinions expressed by hosts, guests, and callers on WSLR programs are their own and do not necessarily reflect those of WSLR, its staff, or volunteers.
Previous shows of Our Changing Environment may be accessed at the WSLR archives. Go to archive.wslr.org.
If you'd like to be notified about upcoming shows, you can join the Facebook group, Our Changing Environment.
And tune in next week at 9 for the Healthy Living Hour with Rebecca Acosta.
And tune in at 9 a.m., 2 weeks from today, on December 23rd, for the next episode of Our Changing Environment.
If you're interested in local public affairs, tune in every Thursday at 9 a.m. for The Detail, hosted by Kathy Antunes. And this week will be hosted by Julie Morris, filling in for Kathy Antunes. And I will be the guest talking about the new college campus master plan.
And don't forget to check out the live music, public affairs, and other special effects at Fogartyville on Lemon Lane, just 6 blocks north of Main Street here in Sarasota.
Right now, stay tuned for Amy Goodman and Democracy Now! At 10 a.m.
Our theme music is Vicky's Vamp, composed and performed by John Lambie.
Thanks again, Elliot.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.